right, well, it's 7 o'clock on my watch, so we're going to go ahead and get started. Just as a brief, very brief introduction, I'm going to let Wes kind of expand a bit more on what we're trying to do with these forums. But just as a brief introduction, our idea is to have these on a fairly regular basis, maybe two per semester, so that we can discuss education and what that might mean in terms of how we can do it better, methodologies, and as well as the reasons for it. And that's what Wes is about tonight, setting the foundation for what education is all about. So let's open with prayer, and then we'll welcome Wes to come up and talk more about that. Dear Heavenly Father, thank you for this opportunity to gather together to sharpen one another as we seek to be obedient to your commands, to raise up our children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. And we're thankful for Wes and Joshua and Toby to share with us tonight, and we pray that we might have just a blessed discussion as we talk about these things. As we thank you for these things in Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.
Thank you. Given the nature of what I want to talk about tonight, I'm not sure that I'll be able to confine myself to the stand. So I may wind up walking away from it, or even down there and tripping over Joshua and Toby's feet. I don't care about tripping over the feet, but if I leave this thing and all of a sudden the volume drops and I need to get back to the microphone and say something, because you gotta get caught up in things. And I'll try to stay here. So before I begin with my remarks proper, Matt said he mentioned that this is the first of what we envision as a series of forums, fora. And there probably won't be any more this semester or over the summer, just because of the nature of the community and activities and so on. But we hope to pick them up again in the early fall. And the group of us that have organized these forums have in mind bringing in people from different educational efforts around the community to give talks in various aspects of education to anyone who wanders in. That would be you. Because this community has, as many people recognize, sort of an embarrassment of riches in terms of educational knowledge and theory and so on. So we have schools and a college, and we have different efforts, people doing things on their own. But what happens then is that with all this knowledge we have in this community, there are other people in the rest of the national community that are interested in what's going on. And so over the years, we've sent out into various conferences across the country and internationally people to speak and to talk about the educational projects that have gone well here. But at the same time, back here in the home territories, there are people who are sending their kids to the schools and the colleges and to tutors and so on, themselves, the parents that is, themselves have often not had a chance to hear just exactly what all this classical education stuff is or what it's about. So we have students getting, we think, a great education at NSA, Logos, and the tutorial services, and all the various efforts going on around town, and parents come here to send their children through these programs, hoping, being quite confident that they'll get a good education, but sometimes not knowing themselves what it's all about. And then there are people who have graduated from college, have gone out into the workforce, and find themselves desirous of coming back and getting a refresher, getting a kind of a recharge. Let me just hear it again, they're thinking to themselves. Tell me again what it was I did and why. And so we're hoping that these forums will simply offer a chance for people to hear what it is that education is about from different angles and from different perspectives. To hear what's gone on in the history of Western civilization in terms of education, to get our batteries recharged about what it is that gets this general Christian community so excited about our education and so on. So we have these forums planned and a series of talks kind of projected into the near future, but I imagine that we're open to suggestions if as time goes by you think of something you'd like to hear about. So we're opening these forums with my talk tonight, which will not be a long one. I'll try not to test your patience. But the topic of my remarks tonight is the goal of education, or the purpose of education. And just exactly what is education for? And in order to In order to talk about that, we could begin by offering some of the answers that we often hear, which we all know are not good answers. Education is to get a job. We all know better than that. A good education will help you get a job, yes, but that's not the purpose of education. Or education makes you a better citizen. It will fit you into culture and society better. We all know better than that, too. That's a sort of a John Dewey 20th century American socializing concept, where education and schooling is meant to make us all fit in and adjust to each other and polish off the rough edges and keep anybody from rising too high above the average, but to make us good citizens in a democratic, egalitarian society. So that's a really bad reason, too. But part of the reason that those are bad reasons is because those answers don't fit what man's end is, what man's purpose is. If in order to ask what is the goal of education, or what is the end, the goal, the purpose of education, we have to ask what is the end of man. And one very famous and excellent answer, of course, is the answer to the first question in the Westminster Shorter Catechism, what is the chief end of man? And it's not, as the Sunday school kid said, his head, but rather the chief end of man is to glorify God and to enjoy him forever. And we recognize this from the scriptures, because the scriptures say whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God, as well as a host of other passages that urge us to consider everything that we do in the light of glorifying God. We're made in the image of God. We're we have the imago Dei. We have the image of God stamped on us. And so the thing that characterizes man most fundamentally and sets him apart from all other creatures is not rationality, as Aristotle said, or you know, he's not a featherless biped, or whatever the definitions of man are. The thing that characterizes man is that he's a worshiping being. He's made in the image of God, and he's made to worship. And so far as we know, no other part of creation is like that. We're made in his image, and being made in his image, we're made to worship. Well, education has to take that into account. Whatever education is, education must be something that moves us toward that end, that helps us to accomplish that goal. So if our chief end is to glorify God, if our purpose is to worship, then education has to serve that purpose and not some other. And of course, there can be more immediate ends, too. The answer to the first question of the Westminster Shorter Catechism is the chief end of man is to glorify God and enjoy him forever. So there are other ends. They all eventually lead to that one because it's the chief end. But there are other ends we can talk about, but they all have to line up with the chief end of man. So to talk this way is to talk like a Christian. A non-Christian couldn't answer this question, what is the purpose of education? Or rather, he could, but he'd come up with a very different answer. Because if the end of man is different for a non-Christian, if his answer to the question, what is the end of man, is a different answer, then he's going to have a different answer to the question, what is education? What's it all about? It can't be helped. So the answer to the question has to do with what you think the end of man is. So one way that education, or one way to look at the question, what is education, in this light, is to consider the word itself, education. And it comes from a Latin word which means, surprisingly enough, to educate. But if you look up in the dictionary, there's an identical word which means to lead out. I don't know why it has two separate entries. I think it's the same word. But the word is educo, to lead out. And we can ask the question, what does education lead us out of, and what does it lead us into? And what education leads us out of, in the perspective of most of Western civilization, is that natural narrowness and bigotry and narrowness of mind that we're all born with. We're born thinking we're God. Anybody who's ever seen a baby knows that. We're born thinking that we're God, and part of the goal of education is to teach us that we're not God. It's like that T-shirt you used to see in the Christian bookstores. There's two rules. One, there is a God, and number two, you're not him. That kind of summarizes the purpose of education right there in the T-shirt. So the purpose of education is to lead us out of this natural narrowness and bigotry and confinement of mind that we're born with into a bigger world, so that we can learn something that we don't naturally know. So what are we led into? And one of the answers is now. Let me take a brief sidetrack here, which will not surprise my former students. But there are a lot of things that need to come into a conversation about what is education. We need to talk about the the seven liberal arts, and we need to talk about the tools of learning, and we need to talk about precision of thought and clarity of thought and so on. But I'm not going to take quite that tack tonight, because in future forums, other people can talk about those and do a better job than I can. But I want to give some examples of what I think will illustrate the purpose of education. If education is to lead us out of the natural condition we're born in into something else, then here's one way to picture it. Education gives us a bigger perspective than we will naturally have. And I've used this example over the years many times in other talks that I've given. But I can remember growing up going into my father's study. His study was the next room down the hall from my bedroom. And his study was a fascinating place to me, full of books on the shelves. And he was a scientist, so they were scientific books and completely over my head. But they were fascinating anyway because they were thick. And lots of them were green, and that was cool. And some of them were dusty, and that was even better. And when Dad was gone, I could sneak into a study and just pull the books off the shelf and paw through them. No comprehension whatever about what was being said in these pages, but it was cool stuff. And what was really amazing was that I knew my father knew about this stuff. He could read these books and understand it. He must be quite the guy to be able to read this stuff. And so I'd plow through his books. But the coolest thing about his study was his maps. He had this big set of maps sandwiched together with particle board and a big hinge on one side. These huge topographic maps of the Northwest and of Idaho in particular. And when he'd be gone, I'd go into the study and I'd throw back the particle board cover and I'd lay on the floor with these maps in front of me and I'd find where I lived, which was southeastern Idaho. And if you know where Pocatello is, I grew up in a little town down near there. And so I would find my town, Aberdeen, Idaho, on this map. And then I would find where my grandparents lived, which was up here in Potlatch. And I would find the distance between Aberdeen and Potlatch. And I would find the road I could take to get there, the route we took when we went to visit Grandma and Grandpa. And I would find the fishing streams that my father and I went to. And I'd find the hunting places that we went to. Now, we'd been to these places before, but in my mind, they were just places I suddenly appeared at. I'd fall asleep in the car and ta-da, we're at Grandma's house. But now, when I looked at the maps, I could see, oh, it's that far. And Grandma's house is twice as far as Uncle Joe's house, and the place where we hunt is the opposite direction. And I began to get a picture of the distance and the relationship between me and the rest of my world that I hadn't had before. So these maps gave me this perspective. They oriented me in the world that I lived in. And then I had the odd experience when I was in, I don't really remember when this was. I remember it being in high school, maybe junior high. But I had a teacher, and I think she was a history teacher, who was writing on the blackboard, and we were talking about some historical event. I don't even remember what it was, but she drew a timeline. And I'd seen timelines before, but for some reason, something about the way she talked today clicked. And as she drew on the timeline, she drew, here is William Shakespeare. I think, actually, we were talking about Julius Caesar and Macbeth. But she drew Shakespeare. And then she said, and here's us, and here's Napoleon. And she started ticking off on the timeline where these people were and where famous events were. Here's 1492, here's 1066, and here's the time of Christ. This was in 1976, so public schools could do Christ. You could put him on the timeline without getting in trouble. And the students started raising their hands, and I may have done it too, and saying, well, what about this, and what about this? And it sort of sidetracked into a discussion of where you would put all these things on the timeline. And all of a sudden, I had one of those kind of shimmery moments where looking at the timeline gave me the same sensation that looking at my father's maps did. I suddenly felt that I was oriented. And although this is in high school, and so for years I'd known about all these people and things, they'd just been these randomly appearing events in history, like my grandma's house randomly appeared when I woke up in the back of the 53 Chevy. But now, all of a sudden, when I looked at the timeline, I felt like I knew where I was in relation to things. They weren't just random things, these random particulars floating in this vacuous cosmos known as my brain. But they were in relation to me. I knew how far back this guy was, and how far back that guy was, and how much further that guy was. So I could see not just what there was, but where it was in relationship to me. I was oriented in time with the timeline, in the same way that I found myself oriented in space with the maps. And it's very difficult to explain it without making it sound more prosaic than it was. It was like this, moment of revelation for me. And ever since that time, those have been governing metaphors for me, the idea of a map and of a timeline, in terms of what knowledge does for me. And I think it does this for everyone, to some degree or another. Not everyone has the shimmery moment, but everyone has this experience of having your eyes open and saying, oh, that's how far back that was, or, hey, that came right after this event. And suddenly, you're oriented. So what we're led out of is this narrowness into a bigger world where you see more things. You're up on a higher hill and you can look over all the brush and the shrubbery and you can see the relationship of you to other stuff in space and time. And I actually, not long after the map and the timeline moments, I remember having a dream once where I was walking in a ditch. I think I'd been working on a ditch on the neighboring farm. I was walking this ditch and the sides of the ditch were higher than my head. And so I'm walking down this long, narrow ditch, and all I could see on either side was the dirt. And it was higher than my head. I could reach up and feel the grass up there, but I couldn't see anything except the dirt below me and the dirt on either side and this never-ending ditch going down that way. And then somehow, like it happens in dreams, suddenly there was a stepladder, and I climbed up the stepladder, and I could look around. I could see over the edges, and I saw that my mother was calling me from the house. When I woke up, I thought, that was a weird dream. I wonder what Mom wants. But as time went by, that started becoming a metaphor for me, too, when I thought about my answer to people's question, what is it that classical education does for you? It gets me up the stepladder so I can look over the edge, and so my vision is no longer a tunnel, but broad, and I can see the meadows over there, and the houses over there, and the river there. So education leads us out of this narrowness into a bigger world, into a bigger perspective, a bigger vision. It gives us a map. Education shows us where we are in the course of civilization. And for Christians, this is especially important, because the study of God's hand in history, the study of the church, is the center of studying history. That's the thing by which we interpret the rest of history. So we have to know what's happened. We have to know the story, the narrative flow. And seeing that map, getting oriented by studying history, by studying the literature of the past, by drawing timelines on boards, that gives us a picture of where we are in the story that God's telling. So this, we're led out of narrowness into a bigger picture. We have perspective. And from that, we gain wisdom. And this is one of the things that people have always thought that education should produce in people, and that's wisdom. Not just knowledge, not just skill, but wisdom. Education produces wisdom. And we know from the scripture that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and Psalm 111:10 says, at the end of the psalm, it says, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and a good understanding have all they who do his commands. So there's understanding and wisdom that comes directly from obedience to what you know. But this is the beginning of wisdom, and God in his sovereignty has allowed us to find wisdom through other means as well. And education is one of the means by which we find wisdom. Education gives us something that we don't have ourselves. It gives us lots of examples. Now, I should take that back. We can experience and go through examples of learning wisdom ourselves, but sometimes we die from it. The point of having examples from the past is you don't have to repeat those mistakes if you pay attention. So, Tacitus, the great Roman historian, says that people do not naturally know the difference between good and evil. And this is why we write histories, he says, so that in learning from the stories of the past, they can learn how to understand good and evil in their own lives, which is a very biblical way to put it. Hebrews 5:14 says that the solid food is for the mature who by reason of use have learned to discern good from evil. So in one sense, of course, everyone knows good from evil because we're all made in the image of God and have in our consciences a knowledge of good and evil. But in another sense, you have to discern what good and evil means in this circumstance and that circumstance and this context and this situation. And so we all know, for example, that it's wrong to steal. But is it wrong to steal in this particular certain situation? If you're walking down the street and the guy ahead of you has got a $5 bill sticking out of his back pocket, and you're thinking, please, 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 and then the bill falls out on the ground. There it is, free for the taking, but you saw whose pocket it fell out of. Can you keep that $5 bill? Stealing's wrong, but would that be stealing? Well, the answer, of course, is yes. You know where it came from. You should pick it up, tap the guy on the shoulder, and say, here's your $5. I wanted to keep it, but, I'm a Christian. But what if you didn't see whose pocket it fell out of. You just find the $5 bill. It's the middle of the day, there's some guy ahead of you on the sidewalk, and you see a $5 bill lying on the ground. It's kind of rustling a little bit. Well, maybe it fell out of his pocket. Now, if you kept it, would it be stealing? You could go up and tap him on the shoulder and ask him if it was his, but he might say no. You don't know. Is it stealing? Now, what if it's the middle of the night and you're walking down Main Street, nobody's around, and you see a $5 bill on the ground? Is it stealing to keep it? Most of us would say no. But what if we change it and make it a bag full of $20,000 bills? Now is it wrong to keep it? Everybody would say yes. Well, why? Why can you keep the $5 bill and not the bag of $20,000? Well, our life experiences tell us, you know, how to answer those questions. In the case of the small bill, nobody's going to hunt it down. If somebody lost $20,000, they'll turn it in and report it to the police station. I should go there. But you don't know that instinctively. You know that by hearing your parents as you grow up. You watch movies. You read magazines. You learn by the experiences of other people how to discern good from evil in this circumstance and that situation. So Tacitus is right. We don't naturally know what the right and wrong thing is necessarily in every situation. We know that some things are wrong and some things are right, but part of the process of growing up in a family, part of the process of going to school, part of the process of reading, is the process of teaching us how to know in different situations what right and wrong is, what good and bad is, what valor and cowardice are, what virtue and vice are. And so the process of education is giving us all these examples from history so we don't have to do them all ourselves and be rebuked and berated and so on. But we can study history and see how the judgments of mankind have landed in this particular case and in that particular case. So we get these stories. And one of the great things about education, here I have to talk a little bit about content. Given all the things I've been saying, you can tell that I think that one of the central aspects of education is the study of history. I think that's easy to demonstrate. Among other things, it's the easiest subject in the school curriculum to prove from the scripture. How many places in the Bible does God say to remember the past? You know, from the Pentateuch right on up to the end of the New Testament, God is all about, don't forget the past. Remember the past. Teach your children when you walk by the way, sit down and rise up. And if you forget the past, these are the judgments I'll bring on you. If you remember the past, these are the blessings I'll give to you. But he's all about remembering the past and passing on that remembrance. Remember what God has done so that you interpret who you are and where you are now properly. And gratitude remains. So I think history is at the center of education. But one of the reasons is history is one of the tools by which we learn this wisdom, by which we gain the stories that tell us what wisdom is. And I tell my students when we're studying Greek history, and I tell them to pay attention to the stories in here because in this old Greek pagan Herodotus, who understands stories very, very well, we can glean these little tidbits of wisdom. He tells the story of Croesus, whom most of you know about. Croesus was the legendary rich man of Asia Minor. And the legendary wise man of Athens, Solon, goes to visit Croesus. And when he visits Croesus, this rich, rich man, Croesus wants Solon, the wise man, to flatter him. And Croesus says, so who's the happiest man in the world, Solon? And Solon, you know, he's going, say me. And Solon goes, oh gosh, I don't know, this guy back in Greece I knew once. And Croesus says, what? All right, fine. Who's the second happiest man in the world? Say me. And Solon goes, it's these two guys that hauled their mother to the Temple of Juno. And Croesus says, what? Are fine. Who's the? And finally, he says, "Why won't you say I'm the happiest man in the world? Look at my vineyards. Look at my slaves. Look at my 17-car garage full of Beamers. Why won't you say I'm the happiest man in the world?" And Solon says, "Because you're not dead yet." And Croesus goes, "What? What's up with that?" And Solon says, "Look, I can't judge your life. I can't judge whether your life is happy until I've seen the end of it. Yeah, you look really prosperous now, but what if you lose it all tomorrow? What if the gods come down on you and you lose everything?" And Croesus says, that doesn't make any sense. But Solon is right. It's like judging a book before you finish it. Until you've turned the last page, you can't say whether it's a good book, right? Somebody interrupts you in the middle of your novel and they say, how was the book? And you go, well, fine, so far. But you have to add, so far. Or you're watching a great video and somebody comes in, you know, visits you, and you're going, would you please leave? Like, why? I'm watching this movie. Well, how's the movie? Well, it's great, so far. But you can't judge the movie until the credits roll and the screen goes black and the music swells unbearably. You can't tell whether it's a good movie. You have to see the whole thing, right? You have to judge the thing in its entirety. So this is what Solon is saying about a man's life. And he says, Croesus, I can't tell you whether you're a happy man until you're dead. And Croesus goes, well, that'll do me a lot of good then. Actually, I can't tell you, Croesus, because you'll be in your grave. I can't judge your life until I've seen the whole thing. And Croesus says, you know, this is stupid. Get out of here. And he sends Solon away. And then years later, we have the famous story of Croesus, this wealthy king, realizing that the Persian kingdom next door is growing in power, and Croesus wants to take them on and conquer them before they conquer him. So he sends the message to the oracle of Apollo at Delphi, saying, shall I go to war against the Persians? And you all know this story because you're all classically educated. The message comes back from the oracle saying, if you go to war against Persia, you'll destroy a great kingdom. And Croesus goes, yes. And he goes to war against the Persians and gets obliterated. And he goes, what? But the oracle said, well, remember what the oracle said was, if you go to war against Persia, you will destroy a great kingdom that turned out to be his own. That didn't occur to Croesus. So he's captured by King Cyrus the Persian, and Cyrus has got him tied to a stake, and he's going to burn him to death. And Cyrus is sitting there in his lawn chair watching Croesus, and he's strapped to the funeral pyre, and Cyrus is sitting there, you know, popping grapes and Doritos into his mouth, and his soldier's about to light the funeral pyre. You know, he's holding his torch up to all this pile of wood. And Croesus is tied to the stake, and he's in misery because he's lost everything, and now he's about to lose his life. He's dying, you know, wretchedness, miserable. And he realizes that Solon was right. And he cries out, oh, Solon, Solon, you were right. And Cyrus, who's sitting in his chair, goes, what? What did he say? What's he talking about? And just then, the soldier has put his torch up to the wood, and he's lit the fire, and the fire is starting to lick up the wood. And Croesus sees that Cyrus wants to stop it. Cyrus is going, wait, put the fire out. I want to ask him who's the Solon guy he's talking about. But now the fire is already burning, right? And so Croesus is up there tied to the stake, and he sees the fire, and he's trying to put it out. And it does no good. And so he calls out to Apollo and says, Apollo, save me. And kaboom, this thunderstorm comes and puts out the fire. It's like, whoa, that was fast. And Cyrus says, now I really want you to cut him down and bring him to me to talk to him. The gods love this guy. What's up with this Croesus? And so Croesus comes over, you know, shaking off the shackles from his arms, kind of rubbing his wrists. And Cyrus says, you know, sit down here. Sorry about the whole fire thing. Sit down here and tell me, who's this Solon you called on, and why does Apollo love you so much? And Croesus tells him the story. Well, there was this guy Solon, this rich man in Athens, and I wanted him to tell me that I was the happiest man, and he wouldn't do it because he said, I don't know, but what, you might lose all your stuff someday. Sure enough, it happened. So I was just saying, you know, you were right, Solon. And Cyrus says, you know, gosh, I should learn a lesson from this, and does, and he makes Croesus a wise, trusted counselor of his own. And so now Croesus has, his life has been saved, and he's restored to a position of honor, and becomes this wise counselor for King Cyrus the Great of Persia. So Croesus has learned wisdom, and so has Cyrus. Croesus has learned wisdom, and so he's just when he thought he was losing everything and he was going to die in misery, and if he had, Solon would have had to judge his life unhappy. But now he's restored to honor, and so, you know, things change again, and now he's back in a good position. So if he dies now, we will judge his life as a happy one. But Croesus, having lost his kingdom, but now he works for Cyrus, he's a trusted counselor, he's still bugged, and he can't sleep at night, and he's laying on his bed tossing and turning, you know, moon streaming in the window, and he can't sleep, and, you know, where's the Tylenol PM? And he's going, why did Apollo say that? All of this could have been averted if he'd said, don't go to war against the Persians. Why did he do that? And he can't sleep, and he's losing weight. And so Cyrus finally one day says, Croesus, you know, what's with you? Your bags under your eyes, the whole deal. What's going on? And Croesus tells him the story. And here's what happened. Here's why I went to war with you in the first place. It's that whole Apollo thing. I can't get over it. And Cyrus says, why don't you send another message and find out what was up? And so Croesus, you know, well, that's a good idea. Hey, I hadn't thought of that. And so he sends a messenger to Apollo another time and says, Apollo, why did you send me such an ambiguous oracle? Why did you say this? Why didn't you just come out and say, don't go to war against Persia, they'll wipe you out? And the message comes back from Apollo saying, well, look, in the first place, buddy, let's have a little gratitude. I gave you 3 extra years beyond what fate had determined for you. You know, so how about some thanks? But secondly, the message comes back, secondly, he says, You know, if you had really wanted to know who the kingdom was that you would destroy, all you had to do is send another guy and ask, and I would have told you. Remember, the message said, if you go to war against Persia, you'll destroy a great kingdom. Apollo says, Croesus, if you had wanted to know, all you had to do is ask, and I would have told you. And then the historian Herodotus, who's telling this whole story, says, and Croesus acknowledged that the fault was his. I mean, everybody who tells this story, at least lots of people I hear telling this story, they end it with, you know, maybe Croesus serving Cyrus or something, but they tell it as though this is an example of the gods messing with us and how the gods always mutter and whisper in corners and never tell us outright what we want to know. But Herodotus doesn't tell the story that way. He says at the end that Croesus acknowledged that the fault was his when Apollo said all you had to do was ask. And now there's a great parallel to this whole story in C.S. Lewis's book, Till We Have Faces. In fact, in a way, this is like a commentary or an interpretation of the Croesus story in Herodotus. And you all know that story too, because you've all read your Lewis and you've read Till We Have Faces, and you know how cool it is. But in that story, the complaint of a central figure is, why do the gods whisper and mutter and destroy us? Why don't they speak out clearly? And the answer toward the end of the book, and I can feel free to give it away because you have read this book, the answer is basically, this is where the title of the book comes from, why should the gods speak to us face to face, though we have faces? The point is, most of us really don't want to know the truth. And in Croesus' case, he didn't really want to know what Apollo had to say. He wanted to hear anything at all coming back from Apollo's oracle that sounded remotely like confirmation of what he'd already decided to do in his heart. You know, so if the message had come back from Apollo and the message was, Croesus would go, yes, I can go to war, he would have taken anything as confirmation. But if he had really wanted to know, find out what Apollo says. Should I go to war against the Persians? And the message came back saying, well, gosh, I don't know, Croesus. You know, now, or as it did, saying, you will destroy a great kingdom. If Croesus had really wanted to know what Apollo had to say, he would have sent back and said, wait a second, who's the great kingdom we're talking about here? And then Apollo would have known that Croesus really wanted the truth and would have told it. That's how the story comes across to me in Herodotus if you read it all the way to the end. And that's how C.S. Lewis suggests we can interpret the story Until We Have Faces. This is, you know, this is a story about men in the ancient world who learned wisdom or who lost wisdom or who suffered. The playwright Aeschylus, who writes a trilogy about Agamemnon coming home from the Trojan War, and you all know this story too, right? Because you've all read your Aeschylus. The Greek playwright in the 5th century tells the story about Agamemnon, the great leader of the Greeks who comes home from the Trojan War, and when he gets home, his wife Clytemnestra murders him because he's been such a wretched father. In the play, the chorus in one of their choral songs, as they're singing their commentary, their interpretation of the action, which is the function of the chorus in the Greek plays, one of the things that they say is that wisdom comes through suffering. And the gods force grace on us, all unwilling. That is, we're unwilling. And he, you know, the chorus makes this commentary, which Aeschylus may be suggesting in the course of his play, that as creatures, we're generally too stupid to learn wisdom, and the gods have to force us to be wise by making us suffer. We don't want to start out being righteous at first, so the gods have to force wisdom on us. They have to force their grace on us. But in all these stories, in this Aeschylus thing I just alluded to, in a long Herodotus story I told you, this is a story, it's a narrative, which I find interesting, my students seem to find interesting, but in the course of the story, we can explore the concept of wisdom and the desire for truth and what the human heart is really like. And so in the course of studying our history, studying Herodotus, not only do I and my students get to talk about Greek culture and all the critical events that happened in Greek culture that led up to the rise of Western civilization and what we are now and so on, but we get these stories that help us explore the concept of wisdom. You know, I don't have to go through, if I pay attention to the stories in my educational career, I don't have to suffer the way the characters in the story do. They suffered for me. I read the story, I learn the lesson from them, and then I've learned something which I now don't have to experience myself, and yet I can benefit from it. Of course, that's assuming we learn from the stories, but Tacitus says, few people know instinctively right from wrong. So here I see Croesus and his mistakes, his pride when Solon comes to him, his self-centeredness and his presumptions when he goes to the God and says, "Tell me what I should do," when he'd already made up his mind. Here's an example by which I can learn to interpret in my own circumstances what wisdom is. One of the other books that I really love teaching is Bede, the great Saxon monk who wrote a history of early England. Bede lives in the 700s, and he tells the story of the coming of the gospel to England, and he goes clear back to Roman times and brings the story right up to the late 600s, his own day. And in the process of telling the story, Bede tells us about Gregory the Great, who lives around 600, who's considered the first great medieval pope. He was a great man for a variety of reasons, but one of the reasons that Pope Gregory was great is because of his advance of missions into England. England, back in the Roman days, in the early centuries after Christ, had been a province of Rome, and Christianity had been part of the culture of England. But when the Western Roman Empire fell apart, and the whole Western Europe kind of went into what people call the Dark Ages, and the Romans pulled out of England and left the old Romano-British there kind of undefended, and the Angles and the Saxons started sweeping over from the continent in the 400s after Christ, Christianity was kind of snuffed out. The Anglo-Saxons were a bunch of pagans. And any remnant of Christianity left in British England was pretty much extinguished. And so under the Anglo-Saxons, paganism returns to England. Well, the story of Pope Gregory, as Bede tells it, is the story of a guy whose heart is for missions to England. Bede tells the story about how Gregory is at the slave market in Rome one day, and he sees these fair-haired young men standing on the slave block, and he says to his friends, "You know, who are those guys?" And his friends say, "Oh, they're Angles." And Gregory says, "They shall sing like angels." And his friends go, "Oh man, that was bad." And Gregory says, "Who's their king?" And the friends say, "His name is Aeli." And Gregory says, "They shall sing Alleluia." Their friends go, "Gregory, we got to get you some coffee." And he says, "Man, what's the name of the country?" "The name of the country is Deira." "Ah, they shall be saved, Deira, from the wrath of God." And his friends, "I knew we shouldn't have brought you here, Gregory." So he's stirred up by the sight of these people, these pagans who had no knowledge of the gospel. And so he sends missionaries, Augustine the Lesser, which is probably not a name people used around him, but they send Augustine to England, and he leads kind of the effort to restore the gospel to England. And so under Augustine, the gospel returns and Christianity begins to spread throughout the island. And Bede's story is what happens when the gospel does that. At the beginning of Bede's history, he says England is made up of these four different races, the Celts and the Irish and, you know, all these yahoos. And he says they're always warring with each other. And at the end of the history, he talks about how there's more peace among them. And in the course of the story, the theme is that the presence of the gospel in England is reducing conflict. It's making peace between people, tearing down the walls that divide people, and so on. And it's the story of the gospel conquering. In fact, he tells another really famous story, the story of Cadman, which many of you know. You do, actually, all of you know this story, but I'm going to tell it to you anyway. So Cadman is this illiterate herdsman who lives and works in a monastery in northern England. And the practice in the monasteries of that day, especially in pretty barbarous times, was to serve as hostels to people traveling through inns. So if you're traveling through a countryside and there's brigands and robbers and ne'er-do-wells all over the place, you can drop in at a monastery and they'll give you a nice meal and a bed for the night, and you can travel on the next day. So the practice in this monastery, which is ruled by the abbess Hilda, is that when guests and strangers are there, they sit around the table, they feed them well, and then there's the after-dinner entertainment where you pass around the harp or the lyre, and you sing a song for everybody, and then you pass it to the next guy, and he goes, "Oh, I know a song." And because everybody could sing, and everybody knew their history and their stories, they entertained each other with songs and with accompaniment on the lyre. But Cadman, this illiterate herd, didn't know the stories. He was illiterate, and he couldn't play the lyre. And so every night, he loved the songs, and he loved the stories and the music. But every night, when the lyre got closer and closer to him, it's this guy's turn, then this guy's turn, he'd sort of sadly get up and excuse himself and go back out to the stables and lie down in the straw and sleep with the oxen, because he was too embarrassed to say, "I don't know any stories." So one night he's gone out to lay in the straw in the stable, and this shining man, obviously an angel, appears to him, and he says, "Cadman, sing to me." And Cadman goes, I can't. That's why I'm out here. And the angel says, "I said sing." And Cadman opens, "Yes, sir," opens his mouth, and out comes this glorious song. That's the story of creation. And then the angel disappears. And Cadman goes, "What was that? What happened to me?" And so he goes inside the monastery and he talks to the abbess and he says, "Look, you know, I don't know if I'm demon possessed or this is from God. I got to tell you, this happened to me. What do you think? Should I do penance? What?" And the abbess says, "Well, let's see if it works again. Sing to me." And Cadman says, "I don't know if I can." She says, "I said sing." And so he opens his mouth and out comes this beautiful song. And she says, "I think this is a gift from God." And from that time on, they make him a brother in the monastery, and he lives there, stays in the monastery. And the other brothers teach him all the stories from Scripture, and he can immediately turn them into music, into poems, into stories. He has this tremendous gift. And we even have a record of some of his poems. But Bede says that then people are coming from miles around to visit the monastery to see Cadman. And a lot of people interpret this, you know, this interest on the part of everybody else as kind of awe over this gift, that a man who is illiterate can suddenly sing scriptural songs. Yeah, whoa, look at that. But there's another way to interpret it. In the context of Bede's whole history of England, the story of Cadman might be saying something different. Cadman sings these songs. He sings his story about the moment of creation and about the angels and the cross and all the stories he tells, but he does it in the old Anglo-Saxon meter, the meter of Beowulf, an old pagan alliterative line, pagan meter. He's telling Christian stories in pagan meter, you see. It's like, you know, can you have Christian lyrics in rock and roll? It's that kind of thing. You know, here's a pagan meter, a pagan art form. Can you do that? Can you do Christian stuff with the old pagan cultural forms? And the answer in Bede is yeah. You know, whether you want to have it in the church service is another story, but as far as the pagan poetry, the forms of paganism, they can be redeemed and turned to Christ's purposes. The story of Gregory and the missions to England and the story of Cadman, all of these stories are the stories of the coming of the gospel into England, and they're all the theme behind all of them is that the gospel comes not to destroy cultures but to redeem them. Gregory says to Augustine, if you can tear down the idols in the pagan temples and cleanse the temples and use them as churches, do it. That'd be great. If they're stumbled by going to the building that they used to worship Odin in, then you have to destroy the whole building. But if you can keep the buildings, that's fine. And so Gregory there sets a pattern for future missionaries. When you come into a new culture, do you have to destroy the culture, obliterate it, level it to the ground, and start all over with a Christian culture? Or is Christian culture the redemption of a culture that already existed? And Bede's answer is that the gospel comes not to destroy cultures, but to redeem them. And in almost every story in Bede, you can interpret this way, from the beginning to the end. But so here's some stories in this, you know, wonderful history, Bede's ecclesiastical history of the English people, that talk about wisdom, the wisdom that Christians need when they encounter cultures, other strange cultures. Another example of the sort of wisdom that we can learn from history. Examples could be multiplied, obviously, but every time I had one, I'd tell another long story. So I want to end with the summary then. One of the fundamental purposes of education is to teach wisdom. And in order to learn wisdom, we study the past. We read the stories, we read the histories of the past. You know, wisdom is an essential requirement for the human creature. We're made in the image of God. We're made to be worshipers. We're made to be to be image bearers and to be sub-creators. We're made to express the image in certain ways, and one of those ways is wisdom. And God's given us the ability to learn wisdom from the stories of the past. I will end here and give you all thanks for your attention, and then I think that we're going to have a panel discussion. So Toby and Joshua are going to come up here and sit with me. And if any of you have questions you would like to ask me about my remarks or anything at all, you're welcome to. So thank you.